Sai Ram, and welcome, dear listeners, to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is a show where I take on your questions on practical spirituality and give answers based on Swami's teachings. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I begin by offering my most humble pranams at Swami's lotus feet. And speaking of Swami's lotus feet, or Charanam as it is called in Sanskrit, today is that historic day, dear listeners, on which Swami declared that saying that I have to go to my devotees, they are waiting for me, and sang the bhajan Manas Bhajare Guru Charanam. It is a very, very important day for all of us. If not for that, I wouldn't be sitting here, Radio Sai would not be here, and you listeners would be listening to something else right now, isn't it? So on behalf of all of us, I offer my most heartfelt gratitude to Swami for choosing to re-enter our lives in this sweet and most endearing form. This being the Avatar Day, and Swami being the incarnation of love, why not begin with a quote by Swami on love? So here comes the quote of this week. I quote, "When you become transmuted in love, the Lord, who is the embodiment of love, will reveal himself to you, awakening your higher consciousness in the flood of universal love." I'll repeat that quote again. When you become transmuted in love, the Lord, who is the embodiment of love, will reveal himself to you, awakening your higher consciousness in the flood of universal love. That quote states in one line what is the goal and how to reach it too. The first step is to understand that the goal is love, the path is love, and the guide who comes to lead us to the goal is an incarnation of love too. But what does it mean to be transmuted in love? Day in and day out, we do actions at home, at work, and in society, and all of these acts are out of selfishness or self-interest. But even in that, there is always a trace of love. We in fact draw our happiness only from that love which is behind all our actions. But we think that it comes because our self-interest has been served. Isn't that why a person who loves more selflessly seems to be more happy? If we acknowledge that happiness actually comes from within when we act out of love, we will slowly seek less from our actions and concentrate more on our intentions. The other way is to expand this idea of the self. Just as a person's idea of selfishness grows to embrace one's spouse and then children and grandchildren, can we expand ourselves so much that it engulfs every being? I'll leave it with that thought, for we have questions to answer and it's time we got to them. So this week too, I have two questions, and both of them have been sent, both the questioners have sent me their questions in their own voices. But the first questioner wishes to remain anonymous, so we will straight listen to her question and with prayers to Swami try to answer her.
Sai Ram, thank you for taking my question. My question is probably a common scenario in many households. My son and husband tend to clash over doing homework or, you know, watching too much TV or playing too many video games. We both are working professionals, so our evenings are very, very tight in schedule. My son, as he's growing, he is also getting a lot more homework, needs to focus more on academics. My husband, really, we both really love our son. I know that he wants what is best for him, and I do agree with him on a lot of what he's correcting. But I don't agree with the way he's doing it. Sometimes I feel he's a bit too harsh, but when I try to intervene, he accuses me of teaching our son to disrespect him. So my first question is how I'm concerned that this will sour their relationship. And so my first question is, how do I approach my husband with the manner in which he corrects our son? The second one is I have tried talking to my son over and over again, but it doesn't seem to yield a lot of results. And I want to know what I can do to approach him in a way in which he can actually, he will actually respond. The third thing is, recently my son confessed to me that he doesn't want to try new things because he'll probably fail. And and then he'll get scolded for not doing well. I want to know what I can do to help balance it so that he is corrected where he needs to be corrected, but he still retains confidence in his own abilities and to try new things. And finally, my fourth question is, how can I help maintain harmony in the home? Because these kind of clashes happen almost every other evening, and it's not helpful to anybody. So I'm praying for the best resolution. If you can give me some pointers on what I can do to help the situation, I'll be very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you for that question, sister. As I generally do, let me try to highlight in points the issue that you mentioned. One, in general, your husband tends to be overcritical of people's flaws, and that has caused a little bit of friction between the two of you. Secondly, now you feel this nature of his is affecting your son, especially when he's trying to correct your son in regular and day-to-day matters. Though as a father, he's right most of the time, the methods seem to be harsh. Lastly, you feel that it is now affecting your child's confidence and also causing more friction in your home and marriage. I should tell our listeners that the summary is based on the question that you just heard in the voice of the questioner as well as the mail that she sent to me personally. Alright, I will try to answer this question in probably two parts. One is, as parents, what you can do amongst yourselves. And secondly, the approach needed towards your son. First and foremost, the more you bring in harmony between you and your husband, more this problem will get solved automatically. I think I will not speak too much on this topic, as that's not the focus of the question. And also, the only clue I have is that one aspect of your husband that you did mention in your question. But in general, a little bit of acceptance of a person or as he or she is will bring in much more harmony than we can imagine. You know, in a gathering of any kind, be it in a family, within colleagues, neighbors, or even society for that matter, this harmony comes only when we are not able to accept each other as they are. We all are changing and transforming, but what we need really is people around us who love us so much that they are ready to be patient with us and accept us as we are in each of the stages of that transformation. So first and foremost, work on trying to bring more harmony into the relationship between you and your husband, and you will see it has enormous effect on the problem you've just mentioned. Now I'll come to what you as a mother and he as a father can do. As I mentioned, when you try to bring in more understanding between the two of you, your judgment of his actions when he is correcting your child will be more objective. You'll be able to see where his approach is right and where it is really wrong. What you can do when he is wrong comes only after that, right? But before that, Swami has said that it is not wrong if in a family one parent is strict and firm and the other is a little more lenient. And a mother generally fits into that lenient and sympathetic role more naturally. You know, we talk so much about gender equality these days, but we don't acknowledge enough the diversity between a man and a woman and how that plays a very, very important role, especially when it comes to parenting. Equality when it comes to opportunity and respect is certainly important, but the fact that the mother thinks differently must be acknowledged by the father, and the mother should accept that the father's approach is quite different from her own. So such an arrangement where the father is more firm and the mother is a little more empathetic is a very natural makeup of any family. But another thing that can be tried is to play this role alternatively. So firstly, explain to your husband that it is not that you wish to put him down in front of your son, but you're only playing the role of a soft parent. Then you can probably invite him to play the role of a soft parent in certain situations. That will also help to a great extent, but a little bit of openness between the mother and father will help in this matter. That is, when you are playing the soft parent, keep your husband informed as to what you told your son. Let him not feel that you're doing it secretly to undermine his disciplining. I would also like to tell you three more points in general about parenting. You may be able to convey this to your husband, even otherwise you can keep these in your mind and use it when discharging your duties as a mother at least. See, these days we tend to put our children through a common process in everything. You know, we put them in a school of hundreds of children, we show them programs and videos, and you know, these have been made for all kids. So the content they consume, be it in their academics or entertainment, the training they go through, all of these are very, very generic. But we know for a fact that each individual is unique. So it is the duty of parents to keenly observe their children and learn about their nature, what are their sensitivities, what are their fears, what they go through in life, and what are they thinking about and worrying about. So being a parent is definitely no simple task. In fact, it is not said without reason that parents are the first guru and God. I know being working professional, it's not very easy, but at least you can keep it in mind and try your best. It's very important to observe children for so many reasons, especially in this modern age. Second point, a 9-year-old today and his thinking is not equivalent to when you were a 9-year-old. I'm sure you know this already. A 9 or 10-year-old child of today, I can say, has the maturity that you had when you were 16. So keeping that in mind while dealing with your child will always be helpful. And I feel this you should convey to your husband too, because this means two things. One is, you cannot treat him like a child always. A little bit more of friendliness has to come into parenting. The second is, with increase in maturity, there is a decrease in innocence too. So sadly, the child's mind starts getting more manipulative to get what it wants. So as a parent, remember that. The friendliness and approach is something your husband should keep in mind, but the latter part is more for you as a mother. So being observant, again, becomes very, very important. Last point about parenting, try your best not to correct or discipline your child in public or in front of others, unless it's very, very necessary. When is it necessary? When your son does something very wrong and you need to tell him that he will not have your backing when he does something so wrong. But it is better to avoid general disciplining in front of others. Again, this is more because of our nature in the modern times. There are two ways we derive self-respect. You know, one from doing what is right and what we call as a dharmic life. The other is the self-respect we derive from the respect others give us. And in this age of the social media, we tend to derive more respect from what others think of us. I'm not saying that what others think of us is not important at all, but it is just that it gives more, we tend to give more weightage to it than necessary. So as parents, you should try to correct this in your child. There is a tip for that, but I'll come to that in the later part of the answer. But for now, I will say this much, that for children nowadays, it is important you don't correct or criticize them in front of others. It would be good if you can ask your husband also to follow this. So those were a few general tips about parenting. Now a few points that are related directly to your son or things you should talk to him about. Firstly, try to understand his relationship with his father. Generally, children tend to look up to their father as their hero. Now, when it comes to daughters, they express this feeling in trying to look for their father's qualities in the men they come across in life. But when it comes to sons, they try to become like their fathers. Both of these is only if the child looks up to their father as their hero. Also, in such a case, it hurts them very badly if they are not able to impress or please their father. So if this is the case, you can try to help him do things that will earn a few words of praise from his father. Make it appear like it's a fun, you know, it's a fun thing that you're trying to do. Try to make him feel you are teaming up with him and helping him try and earn brownie points in the form of a few praises from his father. This way you can also try to inculcate some good habits in him. Another thing I wish to say is, talk to him and explain that he should not fear being scolded or disciplined by parents. One way of explaining would be to tell him that as he grows, as he moves into a college or takes up a job, people will always tend to be critical of him and will expect a lot from him. But the only people who will be critical, expect discipline and decorum, shout at him when he is wrong, but still do all this purely out of love, will be his mom and dad. So what he goes through at home is more like swimming with a life jacket or doing gymnastics with a safety net below. It should give him confidence and not create fear or diffidence. And the final point I would like to make is in regards to the fear of failure in children. I'm sure you will be handling this in your own way, but one effective and I would say essential way to deal with this is by giving them an alternate metric to measure their success. We as a society tend to make our children believe that they are judged only on the basis of the success and failure at the end of their efforts. The other extreme is to tell them, do whatever you want and whatever pleases you. Even that can ruin them. So how do we maintain the balance? There are two ways in which Swami inspired us as students, and I feel you can use these approaches as parents too. One, Swami never wanted all of us to be toppers of the class. Swami would always want us to do our best. So sometimes we have seen Swami celebrating the fact that the student passed in all the, celebrating a student who merely passed in all the subjects, but not say a word of praise to someone who passed with top grades. Because Swami would always acknowledge and applaud effort and improvement. So though on one hand, each one had the desire to do well, top the class or pass with distinction, they knew that to please Swami, one needed to do their best. So automatically, instead of measuring a success based on the result, we would measure it based on the effort. And the magic about this is self-satisfaction, or the feeling of being happy with oneself, is actually closer to effort than result. So over a period of time, you will tend to give your best in what you do and derive happiness from that than from success or failure. The other thing which Swami would do is make it very clear to us that he will tolerate a slip in grades but not slip in character. Now, because of this, me pleasing Swami did not depend entirely on my academic success or my talents. Yes, these things would please Swami, but we would know that what would make Swami ultimately happy is good character. Both these approaches of appreciating effort and seeking good character was very, very good levelers, though a student is in a hostel of a few hundreds, because the ability to excel was within his or her reach. A student does not have to be a topper or a champion. So as parents, can you drive these into your child? That what you want is that he should do his best, and at all times, character, goodness and morality is more important than success. So these were a few points I wanted to share, so let me quickly summarize. First and foremost, try to bring harmony in the relationship between you and your husband. That will solve most of the problem. Second point, as parents, it is okay for the father to be strict and the mother to follow a more lenient approach. In fact, this is the ideal approach. But you can also play this role alternately, of you being firm in some matters and the father being the friendly role, playing the friendly role. But for this, good understanding between two of you is essential. Worst comes worst, you can divide responsibilities within yourselves, which areas of the son the father will take responsibility for and which areas you will take, and try to have less interference from each other in those issues. Then I made three general points on parenting based on the question. Very important to observe your child constantly and learn about him, what affects him, what interests him, and so on. Only this will help you customize your parenting care. Now, sadly, this is something most parents miss out. You can earn a lot of money, put them through the best schooling and extracurricular activities, but all of these, remember, are generic ways of molding a child. The customization happens at home, when parents really spend time in understanding their children. Both are important, but when parents spend all their time in providing only the generic training, and at the cost of this customized training at home, the development will not be complete, or will be lopsided. Second point on parenting, acknowledge that a 9 or 10 year old of today is not the same as when you were that age, which means more maturity and less innocence. So keep this in mind as parents. Last point on parenting, try not to discipline your child in public. You may tell your husband also to strictly avoid this. Then the last few points were about what you can inculcate in your child. Tell him how the disciplining and expectations at home are very different from those that he will face in the world outside, and how he can use it to his advantage. Next, teach him to derive happiness by the effort and doing his best. This can be achieved only if, as parents, you follow the approach of appreciating the effort more than the results. Lastly, teach him that far more important than being successful is to be good and moral. It is this that makes a complete person. I'm sure many of the points I've made, you must be trying already. I hope my answer will enthuse you to continue doing them. If there are some other ones I did mention and you have not tried them, do try them. And with that, thank you, sister, for sending your question to us. The next question is from Sister Bharti from Delhi. She has sent us 3 questions already. This is a 4th question. As I have mentioned before, she's a part of a group of devotees who conduct training in corporates based on Swami's message. So many of her questions are from such sessions asked by people during those sessions. So let us first listen to her question, then we can head to the answer.
Sai Ram Prem, my question today is on dharma. Swami has said that one should always follow one's own dharma. And as per my understanding, dharma would mean righteous action or ethical behavior. Or one could say, in case of us human beings, an individual's conduct in conformity with moral principles combined with spiritual discipline that guides one's life. Now my question is, can an individual follow 2 different dharmas in the same situation or capacity? That is to say, one person may generally be an idealist in approach as far as self-behavior is concerned and wouldn't resort to anything non-dharmic, but the moment faced by family compulsions change their stance. Let me explain this with the help of an example. I know of females who are otherwise true, honest and disciplined in their conduct, but may choose to sometimes ignore the wrongdoings of their husbands because they would not want to confront their husbands to avoid arguments. After years of staying with their husbands, they kind of choose to work in conformity with them, more so because our Indian culture and upbringing ingrains in a female that she would always be with her husband under all circumstances. On the other hand, I know of females who would choose to stand up for what is right and land up having not so comfortable lives with their husbands, or in fact land up in having divorces. Now in the first scenario, a wife chooses to remain blinded under the influence of her dharma as a wife as against that of her own individual self's dharma, more so like Gandhari in the epic Mahabharata. And in the second instance, when she chooses to let her conscience take the better of her as compared to a wife's dharma, she lands up in unfavorable circumstances for herself, her husband, her children, and for her parents. So the question that I have is, what is correct, an individual self-dharma or a dharma of a wife? Now this can be also true the other way around, where a husband may choose to ignore his conscience at the cost of pleasing his wife. Hope to get a reply soon. Thank you so much. Regards.
Thank you, Sister Bharti. So let's start by summarizing the question. We all know that we have to be dharmic. The word dharma translated casually can mean righteous action performed according to moral and ethical codes. Sometimes one may be individually very moral or dharmic, but when in a certain situation may be forced to sacrifice their adherence to dharma to adhere to another code of conduct which is equally important. The example given was a wife who is dharmic may choose to be silent when her husband is immoral because her other duty is also to keep the marriage intact. So the question is, are there multiple dharmas? If so, what does one do when one dharma has a conflict with another? Extending the same example, some women become submissive and over a period of time accept and even embrace the adharmic ways of their husbands. In other cases, women choose to fight and some may even resort to separation rather than live with such a husband. So before answering, I would also like to expand the scope of this question a little more. The same could be said of a son or a daughter in a similar dilemma with parents are immoral or vice versa, or an employee working under a management that is corrupt, or even a citizen under an immoral government. Okay, so the first part of the question, can there be multiple dharmas? So instead of just saying yes or no, I'll explain a little the concept of dharma based on what Swami has very, very beautifully explained, primarily in the Dharmavaini and of course in the other discourses. Yes, dharma is righteousness, moral living and so on, but it's a very, very complex word to be defined only by these words. Now, we use the word dharma even for religion, but that's a totally different context. We'll take it up if and when a suitable question comes. Swami uses 2 terms while talking about dharma. He says, Atma Dharma and Achara Dharma. Swami says that it is silly to think that dharma is standard and same for all. One may be a student, one may be a householder, one may be an old person. Their roles and duties are different. Similarly, the case with different professions and roles within a company and so on. Also, one person is simultaneously a father or mother, boss, citizen, son or daughter, and so on. So each individual's dharma is a combination of all this. And add to this, desha kala paristhiti, or place, time and situation, the dharma of an individual is further modified. Let's go back to the different terms I just mentioned. Achara dharma means the dharma to be practiced. So what we say as a wife's dharma, a son's dharma, king's dharma, bachelor's dharma, all come under this achara dharma, or dharma to be practiced in that particular stage of life or profession. This achara dharma is different for different people. So now let's take my example. So what dharma I as an individual have to follow is a combination of all my roles and responsibilities at home, at work and in society, plus the prioritization of what is important based on time and circumstances and based on my own nature, ambitions and goals. Because of that, the dharma I have to follow becomes very, very unique to me. It's like a patient who needs treatment. There is a standard way how each ailment can be treated, but the treatment is actually based on what is the combination of ailments the patient has, and the age of the patient, and sometimes even affordability. So to become a doctor, first you study all the standard treatments, and then start learning about different case studies, right? Same is the case with dharma too. We can learn about different dharmas, but my dharma has to be decided based on the combinations of different dharmas. And each individual dharma can also be very different from the others. So all of this dharma I spoke about relates to the body, right? What is the gender of the body, the age of the body, the relationship of this body and so on. But there is a dharma that pertains to the atma or the soul, and that is referred to as atma dharma. So does that mean that the atma also has codes of conduct? No, that's not the case. The atma is divine and it knows exactly what is the most appropriate action at every situation. So just like when we were confused as to what do we do at a certain situation, we would turn to Swami and he would give us the most appropriate thing to do. When we turn to the atma, or what is also called conscience, we will know what is the best action to do. So acting in accordance to one's conscience at all times is called atma dharma. Swami says in the Dharmavahini that achara dharma is predominantly guided by fear and desire. And yes, part of it is guided by atma dharma too. So the goal of righteous living is to completely merge achara dharma, or dharma in practice, with atma dharma. And that is why Swami often says, follow the master. And whenever Swami makes this statement, he says that the master is conscience. Why is it important to follow a conscience? The answer is quite simple. As I just explained, one's dharma is so very complex. It is a combination of so many dharmas, and we should know which one takes priority over the other in each situation. Generally, some texts like, say, Manusmriti or Vidura Niti are supposed to be authorities in dharma. If you read them, you will know how it is impossible to really keep a track. What one should do when mother says something and father says something else, whose word must be given priority, between the father and the guru, whose words are more important, when a person is in danger, can one speak untruth, is it dharmic to be silent or to lie, and after knowing all of this, you can still mess up the situation. So instead of all this headache, if one can just tune to one's conscience and learn to obey the voice of the conscience, it becomes far more easy. So immediately the next question is, how do we tune in? So all our spiritual exercises are meant for that. That is why Swami says repeatedly, you cannot have a moral society without a spiritual ambience. That is one thing. The other thing is, dharma is not always complex. Many times it is simple, simply speaking the truth, not harming others for self-benefit and doing what is our simple responsibility. just being more kind and patient, and so many such small things that we all are aware of. So these are simple situations where our Achara Dharma is effortlessly in sync with Atma Dharma. The more and more we follow this Dharma, even slowly in difficult situations, the more we are listening to our conscience, and the more easy it will get to hear and follow our conscience. You know, Professor Venkataraman gives a very, very beautiful and simple example. He says, when you start learning to sing, you try to sing in Shruti of a Tambura. Initially, you need to be in a quiet environment and hear the Tambura loudly to be able to sing in Shruti. After years of practice, when you start giving a concert, even if you're sitting in a crowd and a noisy place, you will be able to distinctly catch the Shruti of the Tambura. So similarly, when we start by leading a dharmic life in simple situations and increasingly hold on to the Atma Dharma in situations where it is difficult, even in very complex situations, the voice of the conscience will give a clear idea of what is dharmic act, what is the dharmic act to perform. We only have to obey it after that. So that is the whole academic background. So just to quickly summarize before going forward, can one have more than one dharma? Yes, one can have more than one Achara Dharma. In fact, one's dharma is always a combination of many Achara Dharmas. And since each one is different, one's dharma cannot be completely identical to another's, though we can say that 90% of it is similar. The Swami says, true dharma is Atma Dharma, or following one's conscience. So since the bottom line of dharma is following one's conscience, in that sense, dharma is same for all. All have to follow conscience at all times, and that is dharma. We can technically and academically arrive at the Achara Dharma of a moment in any situation for ourselves. But if that is not in consonance with the Atma Dharma, it is not dharma at all. Okay, now we will come to the example quoted. A woman is dharmic as an individual, but her husband is not moral. So there is a conflict between her idea of personal dharma and her dharma as a wife. So what should she follow? But before I answer that, some of you might wonder, after that explanation and conclusion that listening to conscience all the time is dharma, is it really necessary to answer this question at all? Yes, it is. The truth is, most of us find it difficult to follow our conscience because our mind tends to reason in a manner contrary to that of the conscience. So we need to give at least some reason to the mind to silence it. And that usually works like magic in trying to follow the conscience. That is the very role of all scriptures and words of Mahatmas and Avatars. They give us reasons to your mind. They give reasons to your mind to enable you to listen to your conscience. So having explained that, let's get to the question. From all the explanation I did, I think at least one thing must be clear. Dharma is complex. It cannot be explained in binaries. Yes, no, good, bad, or right, wrong. But our problem is, we take a very, very simplistic view on dharma most of the times. Yes, as an individual, a woman has a sense of right and wrong, but reacting impulsively and aggressively to a situation based on that discrimination or quitting the scene altogether is not necessarily the right action. When you're clear of what is right and wrong, and you're put within a situation where things are going wrong, your responsibilities become different. So without losing your sense of morality, you must labor to bring a change in the situation that you have to labor to bring a change in the situation. So that is the right method. And even in the efforts, the first few steps should always be through patience and perseverance. Confrontation is the last option, and quitting is rarely the right thing to do. Let us take a similar scenario in a workplace. Say you are a moral person and you come to know there are some malpractices happening in your workplace. Quitting is the easiest thing to do, and the reason sounds very sound. I am a good person, so I don't want to be associated with this bad workplace. But the right thing to do is to use your sense of morality as your guide and slowly labor within your capacity and bring change around you. Isn't that why Swami says, life is a challenge, meet it? In the example of a wife with a corrupt husband that Sister Bharati gave, two scenarios. One, the woman becomes like the husband over a period of time, accepting his corrupt ways. And the other, she begins confrontation and ends up in divorce. Both of these are two spectrums of the wrong thing to do. One is you change yourself for the worse, and the other you try to occupy a moral high ground and lose the challenge at hand. I know of some husbands who do this. You know, they will be incorruptible individuals, but because of the pressure from wife, end up being corrupt. The reason appears sound: a husband's duty to keep wife happy. It's a husband's duty to keep the wife happy. But at what cost? And that is why Swami gives examples of two saints. One is Tukaram and the other is Kabir. Swami says that Tukaram had a wife who would trouble him, and Kabir had a very, very dutiful wife. But both men led saintly lives. Similarly, if you see the Ramayana, the list of noble women is a real eye-opener, what we call Pativratas in Sanskrit. And the list of those noble women are thus. They are Mandodari, who is Ravana's wife, Sulochana, who is Indrajit's wife, and Tara, who is Vali's wife. All were married to evil husbands, or husbands who took to the wrong path. None of them divorced their husbands, but could remain pure till the very end. This is the reason we are given such examples. It is indeed possible to remain pure even when attached to an impure or immoral setup. What we need to do are three things. One, we must retain our sense of dharma and never give it up. Second, we must keep persevering patiently within our scope to bring change. Using aggression should be the last option. Quitting should not be kept as an option unless it is absolutely inevitable. In fact, if we have performed points 1 and 2 most sincerely, Swami within will indicate if at all quitting is an option. I am tempted to give the example of the Pandavas here. You know, their scenario was very similar. They were moral, they had the strength and might to fight for righteousness. They also had the detachment to give away what was rightfully theirs. What did Krishna as their guide do? He made them try all the right paths, made them try peaceful methods, even though they had the courage and might. Then, as a last option, they went for war. And even at the time when Arjuna said, "Let them have the kingdom, I and my brothers will resign to the forest," Krishna called it an act of adharma. What Arjuna was saying sounded so noble. Krishna said it is wrong. Why? Because quitting from a situation in the pretext that I am moral, so I will not put up with this, is also adharma. I quoted Swami's words in the beginning where I said, follow the master. What are the other lines in that same quote? Face the devil, not avoid or run away from the devil. Fight till the end, not give in or give up. And finish the game, which means only when we face the situation and fight till the end, the game really gets over. Otherwise, we will run away from the situation and think that we have done the right thing. But till we learn the lesson, we will be put in the similar situation again and again. So that is the answer I wanted to give for this question. Let us remember, Swami says, dharma is God. And if we truly are seeking to be dharmic, we must be prepared to sacrifice anything for that, including our comforts and our pleasures. And if necessary, even our life. A simple tip that Swami would always give is do everything to please God. Offer all decisions and acts to Swami and say, Swami, if I am wrong, please correct me. I know there was much said in the reply to that question. If anything was not clear or if more questions arise from what I have said specific to the situation that any of you are facing, please do write to me and we will take it up. So dear listeners, that's a wrap on this week's show. Thank you for joining me and thank you for all the encouraging feedback I've been getting all the while. Do you have a question on practical spirituality, or are you in a situation where you are wondering what is the appropriate action to take according to Swami's message? Then you can send me your question and I will deal with it on this show. You can send your questions directly to my mail ID, that's prem@radiosai.org, that's prem@radiosai.org. Yes, it is my personal ID and I alone will be reading your mails. If you wish to be anonymous, like one of the questioners in today's show, do let me know. And finally, I'd really appreciate it if you can send me your question in your own voice. With that, I take leave of you. I offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. You are listening to Radio Sai, Answering Booth.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, we have an important announcement for you, and here to make it is Professor G. Venkatraman. Over to the professor.
Loving Sai Ram, and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. Right from the time I came to Swami a quarter of a century ago, I have always been eager to understand the deeper implications of Swami's core teachings. This activity has been continuous and involved much self-learning rooted first in the Bhagavad Gita and then in Swami's innumerable discourses. Not many may be aware that while the Bhagavad Gita is presented in 700 tightly packed slokas or hymns, Swami has parsed, amplified and expanded them into well over 1,000 or more discourses, going back at least to the 50s when recording devices first became available. Radio Sai itself has in its collection several hundreds of such discourses, and some listeners might be familiar with them via Radio Sai's exclusive discourse channel. Times have changed, and presently life has become so busy for almost everyone that even ardent devotees find little time to reflect on Swami's teachings. As if this is not enough, the literate on the one hand and young people on the other, each group for its own reason, seems to be of the opinion that basic moral values are no longer relevant in a globalized world. Indeed, this appears to be true almost all over the world. In countries of the East, a very large percentage of the population still declare that they believe in religion. Nevertheless, when it comes to actually putting the teachings of their religion into practice, there seems to be little appetite for it. I would go so far as to say that even if there is a trace of appetite, people have no time for feeding even that feeble spiritual hunger. I have been keenly following this drift away from practical spirituality from the time when the disinterest in basic values was a small trickle to the present day when it has assumed almost tsunami-like proportions. I do not wish to sound preachy, but I do feel that there is a definite need to pause and reflect, at least occasionally, on the basic question as to whether it is at all possible to have a global society totally bereft of core non-negotiable moral values. Think about it. You see, the point I am making is particularly important because lately, more and more people the world over, especially the young, are veering to the view that absolute moral values are totally irrelevant in a globalized world. Indeed, the cry is louder for rights and entitlements rather than the duties and the obligations that every one of us owes to our conscience as well as human society as a whole. Keeping this in mind, I have, after consulting a few here in Radio Sai, decided to offer a series of talks every alternate week. Every talk would be short, have a particular theme, and also relevant to the situation prevailing in today's world. That being said, all talks would revolve around what Swami patiently taught decade after decade, indeed going back to an era when the audiences were small and there were no recording devices. This announcement is by way of alerting all of you out there. I do honestly hope you would spare the time to listen in directly or at least the podcast. I would also request you to spread the word around so that those who are not aware can also listen. That's all for now. Thank you for listening. God bless and Jai Sai Ram.
This is Radio Sai Studio back again. As you just heard, Professor Venkatraman would be starting a new series of talks on the broad theme, the relevance of basic moral values in the globalized age. As he mentioned, this talk would be broadcast every alternate week. Because of the importance of the topic, it has been decided to include these talks as part of our regular and highly popular Thursday live programs, but only every alternate week. Please note, on Thursday live, but only every alternate week. We gather that Professor would give his first talk on Thursday, the 27th of October. Please spread the word to the extent you can by all means available to you. Thank you for listening, and Jai Sai Ram.
तुम्हारा रिश्ता इस दिल से दिल ही समझ पाएगा दूर होके भी तुमसे तुम्हारा एहसास करवाएगा पर आज तुम्हारी यादों में खोया किसी बात पर ये रूठा है ओ मां तुम बिन बेजुबा होने की शिकायत कर बैठा है बेजुबा होने की शिकायत कर बैठा है
बतलाया दूर न जाना कभी तुम